Live from Burbank, California, birthplace of Joseph Stalin. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now he gives according to his ability and receives according to his needs. Mark Maron.
Oh, I wish that were true. Geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, and of course you pain sponges and need machines and victims of this horrendous snot virus that Jim and I both have. How you feeling today, Jimbo?
I'm much worse, thank you.
You are? It got worse? It's progressing?
Yeah, I got kind of a cough now. I had to take some cough syrup that everybody says doesn't work anymore. And
did you get the good kind with the codeine in it? Did you get the kind of cough syrup that has heroin in it?
No.
Did you get any of that crack cough syrup?
No.
How about any of that ecstasy cough syrup? You can get cough syrup with any number of things in it now because they want you to party while you're sick. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. Well, thanks for informing me.
Sure, man.
I'll get on that immediately.
I just wanted to tell you about it. I had a tragedy yesterday, Jim, and I'm not afraid to talk about it publicly.
Tragedy?
Well, it was a little sad. I was sitting there doing my work, doing my homework, reading up on this this resolution that's been put forth in the House by House Majority Leader John Boehner in order to make the Democrats look like a bunch of wussies. There's no other purpose for it. I'll get to that in a minute. Reading up on it, with the sun's coming down, and I hear this gank, a little bonk, boonk, like that. Oh. And I just caught out of the corner of my eye a bird sort of winging, like, you know, like injured off of my window. My living room window that I look out of the world in, and I went onto the porch, and there was a little hummingbird, whacked. He was there. He was still alive. Now, I have four felines, and I didn't know really what to do. The interesting thing to me was there was really nothing I can do other than do what any kid does when you find a bird that's been injured. Put him in a shoebox with a napkin, and you put him in the garage. So it reminded me when I was a kid, like, I don't know what to do with it. I can't nurse it to health. I don't know how screwed up it is. But I got this little hummingbird. I made a little bed out of paper towels, and I put him in a little bowl, and I brought him out to the garage so he could die at least quietly without being ripped to shreds by one of my cats.
Jesus. Did he die?
Don't know. I go to the garage this morning. The bird is gone.
Well, then he lived.
Well, he lived for a while. I don't know how long he lived. He'd crapped on the towel bed that I made him. So maybe he said, like, this is no place to sleep. But I don't know. He wasn't anywhere in the periphery of the box. I imagine he's crawled under something and maybe died. I don't know. There was no way for him to fly free. You know, this is important stuff.
And that's what you get for putting that ultra-realistic picture of a hummingbird feeder on your window.
But I was waiting for it to happen. It always happens. It hasn't happened yet. It's sad, but you know, it's the way of the wild.
Maybe Mishna ate him.
Maybe. I don't know. I think she would have. Yeah, actually, she probably wouldn't have told me if she did or not. But I didn't know what to do. I mean, I really didn't, you know, because part of me was like, let it get eaten by a cat. I mean, if I were a hummingbird and that would have happened, maybe that's the way you want to go out. Maybe you don't want to just sit there thinking, like, how come I can't, where's my sugar? I need my sugar. How come I can't get my sugar? How come I can't get out of this bowl? Why am I in a garage? Whereas just, you know, maybe that's better. If you're in the wild. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
How would you like to be eaten by a wild animal? And I think it's better than cancer or just sitting there not being able to eat. Huh? Am I wrong?
I don't think I'd like to be eaten by anything.
Come on, man. All right, so on the show today, Sam Cedar is back, the author of FUBAR and the host of the Clipper Talk here in L.A., Sam's here.
He's host of Clipper Talk?
He is host of Clipper Talk.
Oh, man.
Occasionally he's on out here in L.A., but he is on everywhere else, which he was very quick to make me clear of, because I'm going to do his show after we tape our show, which will be on before our show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go do it. And he made it clear to me that he asked me how would I feel about being on a national radio show. He said that to me, rubbed it right into my face like that. All right. Now, I'm going to be as polite as possible to him. I'm going to be as nice to him as, say, Jay Leno was to Ann Coulter last night or the night before. Was that just last night?
Last night, yeah.
What the hell was that? What frightened me the most about that, quite honestly, I didn't expect Carlin to really kick in much. Carlin's a pro. He's a solo act. He's not a guy that's going to step on somebody in an awkward way and make a big point. He's also getting frail. And he's old, and he sort of felt that last night. Carlin was very reflective. He talked about death. He talked about friends dying. And, you know, he's 69 years old, and he's happy to be alive on some level, as cranky as he is. So Coulter comes out with her shtick. And the thing that horrified me was just there was such a tremendous response from a very good part of the crowd in the Tonight Show audience. And I found I felt contempt and hatred for them. I didn't know that. I mean, I know there are conservatives out there, but I didn't realize that they were proud publicly like that. Since what the hell is that?
I don't even. Do you think it's really conservatism, or they just don't care, or no? You know, they just say,
no
hey,
way,
here's
no
a
way.
Famous person is creating havoc.
No way, no way. She was saying, you know, her stuff. She was talking about conservative men, that she walks around with a conservative man who will protect her, that she couldn't expect that from a liberal guy, and she really was doing the emasculating thing. Apparently she didn't know me and the fact that I know Taekwondo and the art of running away. And there's no shame in that. But, you know, I can certainly out-talk any of her conservative male friends, I would imagine, Jim. But the thing that I found really pissed me off is that it sounded like half the damn audience was like, woohoo! Like, not just a little bit, but, like, enough to make you go, where the hell are we? This is our turf out here. This is right down the street. This is California. I don't know where the hell those people come from, but someone should have put a muzzle on them, or else the liberals should have hissed louder.
You know, this is where Wally George started in Orange County.
I
think it's the Wally George syndrome. People are just like, hey, she's an a-hole. What? Say something stupid.
But, yeah, okay, you know, I'll entertain that idea, but I tend to think that perhaps maybe there was something orchestrated by one of the right-wing blogs. Maybe they stacked the audience. It sounded peculiar how much support she got for talking about how these widows. And you know what the argument? Her argument is faulty. It's obviously, but it's faulty in the sense that the people that she refers to as Democratic spokespeople are not Democratic spokespeople. They are victims of different situations that are speaking out publicly about their condition. It just so happens that some of them align themselves with the Democrats because the Democrats are sympathetic with their cause. These are not. She claims that the widows, the four women from New Jersey, who speak together, who've unified, the 9/11 widows and Cindy Sheehan, are somehow or another Democratic spokespeople. That is not the case. These are people that are victims that have causes of their own that perhaps Democratic politicians or Democratic ideology aligns itself with them, but they are not spokespeople. There's plenty of spokespeople she can talk back to and argue with if she wants to. This is just part of their plan. It's like I was talking about yesterday, making the victims of Katrina look like a bunch of irresponsible spendthrifts who just want to party, or making these women and Cindy Sheehan look like these, you know, sad, crying people who are shilled out by the Democratic Party to do what they're doing, is part of their blame the victim manifesto and take shot at the most helpless of us, or people that are in the most pain.
Her other faulty premise is that these people are untouchable, that you can't criticize them, and they've been criticizing them from the very beginning.
Well, that's true, but I think what she says is that you can't debate them because in public debate with somebody who says that they're against the war because their son was killed, you know, it's always going to be an emotional argument. And she is claiming that she is somehow some sophisticated, you know, detached debater, which she is not. She is a victimizer and a predator in terms of what she is doing publicly. But I think that is her contention. It's not so much that they are beyond reproach, but if you were to argue policy with them, you couldn't because they are victims of bad things. I think that's what she's saying, and I think it's a false argument meant to kick dirt into the face of people that have already been hurt, which seems to be a theme with these people. And, you know, sometimes I had a conversation with somebody about liberals do it too. We do it to our own a little bit, and I'm guilty of it myself. Another thing I wanted to bring up, outside of this House resolution, which I guess we'll get to. Maybe we'll talk to Sam about it a little bit. Who else is on the show? That's important. I just announced Sam, and we're here. How do we get here and we just announced Sam?
We have Nanette Fabre is coming on.
Is she again?
Yes.
It's weird when she hangs around. Sam Cedar, as I said. Eric Bollert, author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. Paul F. Tompkins, the comedian, the cad, the host extraordinaire. He does a monthly show over at Largo. He's done a lot of stuff. He's funny. And also, I'm glad we got to speak to him. We talked to Marjorie Cohn yesterday, and today we are going to be speaking to First Lieutenant Aaron Watata, the Army officer who has publicly stated that he will not go to Iraq if sent out of protest of what he sees as an illegal war. This is the guy we talked about yesterday who will be facing a court-martial, and in court he will make his case. We will talk to him. And Johnny K Street as well. The other thing I was going to talk about is I had a did you check out that video of that Marine singing Haji Girl?
No, I did not.
Well, I looked at that, you know, and the Center for Islamic American Relations, they got worked up about it. It was on the YouTube briefly, and I watched it, and it made me a little, you know, the South Park thing,
mm-hmm.
the my defending of South Park.
Yes.
Well, this guy in his chorus used the Arabic language mocking that they used in Team America to sort of propel his little cute song along.
Really?
And yeah, and I had a tinge of regret for my defense of South Park, because this was definitely an interpretation of that movie that lent itself to embracing a sort of, even though it was an American Marine, it was definitely trivializing and racist and inappropriate and heinous. And I had a moment of like, oh, wow. You know, do I still stand up for them? And yes, I do. We will be back with Sam Cedar in just a second. Stay with us.
Crisp, tender chicken breasts. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Most of you folks know Sam Cedar is the host of the Majority Report here on Air America Radio, but I know Sam Cedar as an aspiring comedic talent in Boston, learning that stand-up wasn't for him. I remember the same Sam Cedar wandering around the streets of San Francisco in the early 90s, trying to figure out where he fit into the world and eating at my apartment. I remember TV star Sam Cedar at the center of the sitcom The Show, or the Sam Cedar that directed and starred in Pilot Season, the film, and then Pilot Season, the sitcom that I was in as well. He directed I'm with Busey for Comedy Central. He directed the Lost film, The Bad Situationist.
Right.
Which apparently I have...
A Bad Situationist.
Huh?
A Bad Situationist.
A Bad Situationist, which I have yet to see.
Right.
What I am told as one of the great Marc Maron performances.
It's probably the best Marc Maron performance.
Interesting. So, and you've also written this book, which you're out selling. You brought a bag of them. I think that's nice. Do you sell them out of your car, or is this...
Yeah, absolutely. I brought a bag, but you're going to have to pay for them. It's FUBAR, America's Right-Wing Nightmare,
yeah,
that I co-authored with Stephen Sherrill.
Who's a very nice guy and a smart guy and a funny guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as I recall, when you got the book deal, you said, it'll be fine, he's going to write most of it. And then
that was the plan, anyways.
Yeah. And how did that turn out?
Well, I tried to get him to write most of it. I mean, he turned out to be as, we both, like, it, you know, it was about a year worth of writing that we all did in about 3 weeks.
Uh-huh.
You know.
You crammed? You had that panic?
We had a little bit of a cramming situation.
Yeah.
But, no, he wrote most of the funny stuff.
I read the entire Chronicles of Narnia in 4 hours a day before I had to write a book report on it. Similar kind of situation.
Good for you. I would have done the Monarch notes.
Yeah, I was in fourth grade. I didn't know they existed. But anyways, that's neither here nor there, Sam.
Right.
Hey, are you doing all right on the book tour?
Book tour has been amazing. We were in Vegas. We were in Portland. We were in San Francisco, Seattle. We're going to Washington on Tuesday, and we're going to do another one at the Strand in New York. But the best part actually was meeting all the bloggers.
Oh yeah, who blog on your show's blog?
Yeah.
And have any of them made you frightened?
No, absolutely not.
Well, that's
actually
nice.
You know, I anticipated like, well, maybe somebody will, but no, there was. Well, I don't even want to talk about it because there was somebody else who made me frightened. But
go ahead.
The point.
No one. This is a local show.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
All right. I can talk about it. No, a guy came up to me and he's like, "Hey, it's." I'm not going to say his name, but
yeah.
Hey, it's Mark.
Yeah.
I was like, "Oh, hey, how you doing?"
Yeah.
Mark Maron.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hi. How you doing? You don't remember me? No. I've been writing to you for 2 years. Oh, okay. I don't remember.
Oh, no.
I don't know if I got any of those letters. What do you mean you didn't get any of those letters? You've been responding to them on air.
Oh,
and at this point, I am looking around. Where's Josh, my producer?
Yeah, like, yeah,
you
help
know,
me.
You're going to have to grab his arm when I duck under the table or something.
Right,
he pulls
right.
out and he's just like, you haven't received any of my letters? You've been responding to them on air. You've said my name. And I was like, boy, when we moved, things got really jumbled up. Boy, that first CEO, man, he screwed all of us. He just sort of walked away with this, just eyes locked, just sort of, and I honestly, I was a little bit nervous.
Do you remember him now? Have you responded to his letters?
No, I'm going to go back, and I'm going to be searching the office for something.
Oh, a lot of times those people just need a little, like, yeah, thank you.
It wasn't like that.
Oh, really?
No, it was more like, I am searing this moment in my brain, but you are going to pay for it.
Was the impression that he was helping you or that he was sending you hate mail that you were responding to?
Don't know. Oh, apparently, I was responding to it, though, on air.
Oh, that's horrible when you can't tell the difference whether they're friend or foe.
No, he didn't. I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. It was clearly it's not about supporting you, Sam. It's not about criticizing you. It's about you and I.
Oh, man.
We're the only people out there.
That's sad when fandom becomes so extreme that
I don't even know if this was a fan.
I know. That's what I'm saying. That stalker and enemy. I mean, stalker is obviously an enemy. But, I mean, you don't know whether he's right or left or what.
No, I had no idea.
You just know he's creepy.
You know, that was the one thing I was impressed by. For him, it wasn't about politics. That's refreshing.
We get care packages. Do you ever get any care packages?
Oh, sure. Yeah, all the time. Are you kidding? I had one of our bloggers showed up and gave me like a dozen ginger cookies that she baked and a vegan banana bread. And that's why I think I gained about 5 pounds on this trip.
What's her name? Her first name? Her blogger name?
A.K.A. Matt.
Oh, because we get that kind of stuff, too.
Yeah, we got a lot. We got more than that.
No, we get a lot more than that, too. I mean, we get a lot more
we
than
always
that.
Used to get.
That was the first example that came to mind.
I remember the...
Because I'm on the road. I'm still getting my mail.
Oh. Wow, okay. Yeah. Well, I see.
I remember the great care package wars over at the original Air America studios where you'd walk into the Majority Report office and there'd just be cases of beer and shrines to Janine. And
yeah, she would get a lot of like Red Bull and stuff like that.
Dude, I remember some guy sent her like this weird art project that
was designed
to be hung, and he got pissed off and asked her to send it back to him.
Wow, I didn't follow that.
Do you? We don't need to talk about Janine. So the book, is it selling?
The book, I apparently it is. You know, it's we did pretty well on Amazon for a while. I think
you can't rely on that. Sam.
No, I don't know, but I've seen it in airports, and literally Steve and I, we fly into an airport, and the first thing we do is run to the bookstore, and then I've replaced the FUBAR presentation. I've moved Jim Belushi's book. I don't know what it is. Like, I'm proud to be a complete moron or something like that.
Yeah.
And then we keep putting copies of FUBAR in front of the Ann Coulter's book.
Oh, good.
So that's the one thing I want to encourage. If you don't want to buy the book, by all means, you know, don't buy the book. But at the very least, you should go into bookstores and make sure that you place FUBAR, America's Right Wing Nightmare, over those right wing screeds.
The placement strategy. It's a really funny book. So stay with us for one more segment, then you're going to go do your show across town. We're talking to Sam Cedar, star of the show.
Now, let us know if you have any questions. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Our guest in studio is the director of I'm With Busey, Sam Cedar.
I'm so glad you're on at this time of day, because in the morning it was just too much. Right?
It was impossible.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, well, I'm on a nice schedule right now. I hope we can maintain it. That's all I'm going to say. I don't know.
Listen, gosh, I don't know.
What's going on with your show? Huh? How's everything at Air America back in New York, Sam?
As far as I can tell, the building's still standing.
Uh-huh.
Janine and I are actually not talking to it right now. I mean, we were
talking to the building?
Talking to each other.
No.
Well, we've taken separate vacations. I'm doing this. This is weird. She went down to hang out with the Minutemen. Apparently, she got like...
The band or the people on the border?
No, the guys on the border.
Not Mike Watt?
She got a shotgun. They ticketed her for using it in Central Park. She was trying to shoot squirrels. She went down there just to blow the thing off.
Oh, really?
I don't even think she really cares that much about the immigration thing. Really, she just likes to shoot the shotgun.
And wear the fatigues?
Yeah, I know.
And the hat?
She's been doing that for months now. It's been awkward.
What? Now, okay, so we're going to... Are you really not talking?
No, we are talking.
Yeah, what is she doing?
We did have a fight, but
about
we
what?
Fight. We fight about everything.
Did you do it
feud
on air?
Huh?
I heard there was a feud.
There was a feud. We had a fight. I mean, it's, you know, she was gone for a long time. She came back, and you know, she likes the lifestyle.
You moved her chair.
I moved her chair. Now she likes to. She has the opportunity to do a lot of films and stuff like that. And I think, you know, sort of the. she's still trying to figure out how to integrate a daily radio show on her
own. It's hard for her, yeah. And for someone like you, it's pretty much done, you know, is over
for most practical purposes.
Well,
you know, over really, it doesn't even do it justice. Yeah. I don't know if I ever really started.
No, so, I think you did. I think there was a lot of starts.
Yeah.
And a lot of starts.
There was no middles.
Right. But no.
A lot of beginnings.
What are you kidding me? You did a great film, Pilot Season's great, funny film.
It's actually entitled Who's the Caboose, but that's not really, I guess, that.
Pilot Season is the...
Pilot Season is the TV show. The six-part sequel to the movie Who's the Caboose,
which I had a very small part in.
Right.
And then I was in Pilot Season as a different character. Yeah. And I thought that was great.
No, it was great.
And you were kind of on that.
It was
and
then probably one of the best TV programs of the year that year.
No, I think so. And then you got this opportunity to do this.
I can't even pick a fight with him.
At the same, what happened?
Nothing.
What?
Go ahead. No. It's awkward getting these type of compliments from you.
Well, look, Sam, I spend most of my time, like, you know, sometimes I'm jealous of you, and then I say to myself, oh, poor Sam. You know, I mean, you know what I mean?
I was going to say, I'm looking at you, you're tan, you're wearing shorts, you're living the life out here. I feel like my throat's about to fall off. I got to go back, hustle, you know, I'm hustling up back in New York, dealing with the suits.
But you're part of the big game. You've made yourself. That's what you are. You've created. You did the bow tie thing, which was cute, and you know, it's like
that was just to confuse people. I wanted people to think like, "Hey, why is Tucker Carlson doing liberal stuff now?"
Yeah, I'm a pundit, and occasionally you show up on the shows to entertain those people. You like arguing with the conservatives, but you've integrated yourself with the Democratic machine. Am I right?
Not so much with the Democratic machine. I mean, I think there are a couple of Democrats I like, but there's a couple that we specifically do not have on the show.
Yeah,
and
like who?
Well, I mean, we don't have Hillary Clinton has never been on
or Joe Lieberman.
Joe Lieberman. never mind, Joe Lieberman. I have had Ned Lamont. Ned Lamont announced his candidacy when I was hosting Randy.
Yeah.
Then I had him on when I was subbing for Frank, and I've had him on three times on our program. I would do anything for Ned Lamont. I've been after Lieberman for a long time. I've had a big problem with him.
He's the worst.
And you know, look, my opinion about the Democrats is it's a vessel for change and specifically to stop the bleeding in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't see the Democrats as any type of panacea. I don't I'm not. It's not a question I have some type of self-identification with the Democrats. I mean, in 2000, I voted Nader. Now, I vote swapped.
Woo!
And I vote swapped. But listen, and I was voting in New York, so it wasn't terribly that relevant. And I'm not sure if I had done it in a closer state, it would have been different. But the bottom line is right now the Democrats are the way to stop the hemorrhaging that's going on.
Right.
And, you know, when you see things like Tester and even Webb, who is a fairly conservative Democrat.
Right.
But he is one that was not the corporatist pick.
Right.
My biggest problem with the Democratic Party is about a third of it is still very corporatist.
In fact, guys
like Steny Hoyer, and frankly, I'm not terribly thrilled with Joe Biden either.
Well, he's kind of owned by the credit card industry, right?
He's owned by the credit card industry, and he's one of these guys who just love, you know, every time I hear him talk, I feel like in his mind he is just thinking about that portrait of him as a senator that's going to be hanging up in a while, and he's just thinking, should I take my arm and put it across my chest this way, or should I move it that way?
Well, I think what I'm saying to you, Sam Cedar, is for the years that I've known you, I'm proud of you. You've done all right for yourself.
Thank you very much.
You're a bright young man. You're a mensch, and now you're standing up for what's right.
You know, when I was in San Francisco, I was walking around going, this is where I served my internship with Marc Maron.
Oh, boy.
I followed him from a comedy club to comedy club, and I sat with him as he was smoking his cigarettes. I mean, we talked about
this. And he came over to the apartment when I was with Kim, and you had dinner, and I still had your chair in New York and everyone.
Wait, it's still in New York?
Yeah. Well, you want it?
Well, sure. I mean, if you're not using it.
Well, it's in my apartment in New York. You can get it. I think it needs to be reupholstered.
Reupholstered? Wasn't it all wood?
It was all wood, but it had that the foam on it. It was upholstered. It's a classic old chair, but the cats have destroyed it. Now, let's talk about the reissuing. I know we were talking about politics, and some people are going to be angry that we derailed that. Well, okay, let's
No. Wait, let's talk about something different, because we're going to talk about politics on when you come on to the Majority Report.
Well, okay.
Before now.
That's going to be before now. Okay, we'll get into the Boehner resolution.
Yeah, you're mispronouncing his name. It's Boehner.
Boehner. Doesn't he want Boehner?
No. I think it was originally Boehner.
Boehner.
And he changed it to Boehner.
I thought he changed it to Boehner.
Boehner? I would double check that. Boehner.
Well, you would probably know.
French-Canadian, I think it is.
Uh-huh.
French-Canadian. Boehner.
Yeah. And he's owned by the cigarette companies, right?
He's
tobacco?
Owned by just about everybody. I mean, they're all a joke. I mean, Denny Hastert's got this land deal now. Jerry Lewis is getting subpoenas. Not the Dean Martin one, but the other one.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so then if we're going to talk about that before this show, and that's people are going to be tired of hearing you and I talk, let's talk about the reissuing of A Bad Situationist.
Well, it's not being reissued. It's being issued for the first time. This is the movie, and honestly, I would say 98% of people who see it, your scene is the one that sticks out, and people are just amazed at your performance in it. And you play a radical Orthodox Jew,
mm-hmm.
postal worker.
Yeah.
And the movie is, we shot it in the summer of 2001, you'll remember. I played Joe Lieberman's screwed-up son.
Yeah,
because
right.
I still had a, I don't know, can I say hard-on for Joe Lieberman at that time? And he was pissed about the election. His father installed him in a co-op apartment with the hopes that he would lay low, and he ends up starting an intellectual salon based on the back-of-the-book reading of The Situationist International.
Yeah.
And there he is inculcated by you and John Benjamin, two radical
Orthodox
Jews who are a member of this sort of ancient sort of Bar Kokhbin, if you'll remember, organization. And Bar Kokhba was a rebel fighter against the Romans back in the early days. And he is inculcated to commit a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
And it ended with Joe Lieberman's son on the roof of a building aiming at another building.
Right, with a bazooka,
with
right?
a bazooka.
Yeah.
And then we were 8 weeks into editing when September 11th happened.
Right.
And for some odd reason, my finishing fund company decided, we're not going to want to be involved in this anymore. We've given you, you know, and it's a very low budget movie.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
so, you know, we did it for under $100,000, I think. And they were supposed to give me 60 to finish it, and they gave me 10 before they saw the movie. They never saw the script. That was one of the things. And then they said, look, you can keep the 10, just don't put our name on it. So it's taken me now 5 years to finish
it. Now, in terms of finishing it, what did you have to change things because of 9/11? Or did you do you think that enough time has passed to where it won't be connected with that?
No. Well, I mean, look, it's
I do remember making a presentation where there are terrorists in planes.
Yes,
and suggesting
exactly.
That,
yes.
Didn't I suggest that they fly them into buildings? Or?
I don't know. That if you did, that did not make it in. but the changes I made were, I mean, I changed it one way, I changed it another way, but, I mean, the whole thing was so devastating. And I just put the movie aside for a long time.
Yeah.
And I've cut it down. It's impossible for me to know how it would be different, you know, otherwise. But I think the gist of what I've just told you is the same.
Why don't you just are you going to make it available on DVD for purchase? Are you going to try to do a theatrical release?
I'm
what
actually,
are we doing?
You know, I was thinking about doing DVD. I'm actually thinking about trying to resurrect Beta.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, this
the
is...
The tape?
Yeah, the Beta tape.
I have some Beta tapes.
Well, there you go. Now, I'll put it on DVD. I'm going to put Who's the Caboose on DVD, and I'm sure it will be as successful as the Majority Report versus the RNC DVD.
That did very well, didn't
it?
Oh,
yes, yes. Actually, we have 5,000 copies still sitting in our office that we actually use as furniture now. You know, retail, not my strength.
I thought that you were tied in with the blog community. What does it take for them to throw you a few bucks?
Well, you know, I don't know what happened with it. Well, one of it was we lost the election. I thought, I'm going to hold this DVD until after the Democrats win. And then I'm going to be able to charge 14% more. And I'm going to make hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
And but no, I'll put it, I'll figure out some way of selling. You know, I'd like to get it out there just if only so that you can see it.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to see it. And I think
I'll
the
put
world
it on markmaron.com. Are you kidding? I'll make a mint.
Yeah. I have sold maybe 4 CDs in the last 3 weeks off of my website.
Well, there you go. How do you do the delivery? I mean, that's the thing is I couldn't figure out how to actually. You got to mail them. People contact you mail them out.
Yeah,
I don't want to be in that business.
Yeah.
The e-fulfillment business is not the one I want to be in.
Well, let me tell you something. If the product isn't selling like hotcakes, it
it's
ain't
not
that
a
big a deal.
There you go.
All right. So the book is FUBAR. It's very funny.
America's right-wing nightmare. Go to FUBARTheBook.com for more information.
You can go to my website and link to Powell's because it's the right thing to do, or you can go to Sam and link to Amazon so he can watch the numbers go up and down. You know, when somebody buys one book, that played against however many other books sold during that day could make your book go up like 100 on the Amazon count.
Yeah, so at the very least, if you're not going to buy FUBAR, please do not buy any other book on
Amazon at all. Just for a few days.
Yes.
Just so Sam can feel better for a few days.
Exactly.
All right, so I'll meet you over at KT. TLK and do your show, which will be on before our show.
This is a great show. I wish we could hear it in New York, honestly.
Me too. Maybe we'll make that
happen.
We're
working on it. We're working on it.
You're working on it too?
Believe me, buddy. I got a master plan.
All right. Sam Cedar will be back with more show in just a second. Stay with us.
He's riding on the big bus now, Mark Maron.
I sure am, man. You know, I guess I probably could have killed that hummingbird. Put a mercy killing.
It sounded like it got away.
Euthanized him.
I think it got away.
Well, okay, I'll be optimistic.
It was stunned and it woke up and it left.
Okay. All right. Okay, I'll go with that. But I there's no way it could have gotten out of my garage, and I couldn't kill it because the one time I killed a mouse on a glue trap, it has never left me. It has never left my heart. The one time I shot a pigeon with a pellet gun, it has never left my heart. Both of those animals are in my heart crying for eternity. Hey, tonight, Sam Cedar's book signing at the 826 L.A. space of McSweeney's. That's 685 Venice Boulevard, second floor in the Sprague building. You can go to markmaron.com, and there's information there. People, it's obvious that the mainstream press has either cozied up to this administration or become completely impotent in the face of it. Usually it's the cozying up. Using Bob Woodward as an example of what was once the press when he cracked the Watergate break-in and what it has become now, and what he's become now is this Bush lackey, an apologist, a biographer. How did that happen? Eric Bullard answers that question in his new book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I kind of garbled up that intro, but let me just ask you right off the top. Aren't journalists ashamed of themselves for collectively sucking?
I see no signs of any self-doubt. I see no signs of remorse. I just see this. You know, people ask me, you know, I was actually on Fox News the week the book came out, and they were saying, oh, you know, this book is 2 years too late. You know, you could have sold us, you know, in 2004 or 2003. But come on, you know, the press is so tough on Bush. And, you know, look at those press briefings, what they did to poor Scott McClellan. You know, the fact is, I actually think it's getting worse. I mean, I get more depressed in the last month since the book came out in terms of the coverage that we're seeing. And the press has absolutely no interest in self-reflection or criticism. They think they got it right, and you know, they have no interest in looking at my book or the last 5 years and the factual evidence that I lay out.
It's baffling to me. But let's talk about this idea, because I know you talk about it in your book, this myth of balance. Who decided that everything needed to be balanced? Isn't unbiased what it should be, or objective as possible? What is balance?
Yeah, or accurate. That's usually a good one. Yeah, I mean, you know, Fox got half of it right. Fair, you know, fair and balanced. All journalism should be fair. All serious journalism should be fair.
Right.
This notion, you're right, that all journalism should be balanced, that was hand-delivered on a plate from the right-wing critics who've been yelling liberal bias. I devote an entire chapter to the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, and specifically the media coverage, and I don't think there's a better modern-day example of how the press sort of walked away from fairness and inserted balance. So they spent the month of August 2004 documenting over and over again. I mean, CNN couldn't stop talking about this literally for 3 weeks. These bogus allegations about Kerry's war record, and then they would run over to Kerry's camp, and then they get a response, and then they'd throw up their hands, and they'd say fog of war. You know, we can't figure out what John Kerry was doing in Vietnam. Well, you know, the U.S. Navy knew exactly what John Kerry did in Vietnam. It's all on record, all the documents.
So
the Swift Boat Veterans couldn't produce a single document to back up their charges. They came forward 35 years later. A lot of them had changed their position publicly, but the press, sort of obsessed with this balance, decided we can't figure out who's telling the truth.
Well, why didn't they investigate? What is it that stops? Like, I know there's a couple of good reporters out there.
Yeah.
Oddly, or maybe not so oddly, they're probably in their 50s or 60s.
Right.
Because they were part of the original wave of real reporting.
Right.
And I know that this administration, it seems, is incredibly diligent in utilizing the bureaucracy to make sure that these reporters, you know, either get, you know, taken off of the track or given information that'll baffle them or just exhaust them.
Right.
But still there's no excuse for this. Why? What is it about the current structure of news operations and in all forms of media that has allowed this to happen?
Well, if we go back to the Swift Boat specifically, it's even worse because, you know, that story wasn't per se controlled by the White House. It's this sort of reverence of Republican hardball, and it was the fear in 2004 of calling the story out for what it was, which was a hoax, which was a, you know, Republican dirty trick, nothing more, nothing less. People, serious people, who looked at it, who looked at the facts. I mean, it was sort of convoluted. I understand why, you know, it wasn't debunked in day three or day four, but by week four and week five, I mean, people understood what was going on, and they were just afraid to call it out for what it was, because they knew it was going to ignite the right wing during the presidential campaign.
Ignite the right wing against them, the press?
Oh yeah, you know, the conservatives have been waging this battle against the mainstream media for going on 35 years, and it's produced extraordinary benefits in terms of the rabbit ears, you know, that journalism have developed, and they're just bending over back. I mean, during the Clinton years, how did you prove you weren't liberal? You know,
right.
Well, if you worked at the New York Times, you wrote about Whitewater for 5 years,
right.
Even though it turned out to be nothing.
Yeah.
And if during the Bush years, how do you prove you're not liberal? You go on TV and you talk about how resolute Bush is and how authentic and how he doesn't pay attention to polls.
Well, it seems to me that I've always thought that there really is no liberal media. There seems to be a right-wing media and a generally irresponsible media.
Right.
But the problem is that the groups that you're talking about, the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, these guys are backed by a lot of money. It may not be administration money, but there's a lot of money going into manufacturing these stories and making the culture feed on them. Now, why is it that most of these writers or most of these journalists buy into this? Is it because they know that same money will take care of their careers for years to come, whether as speaking engagements or...
I don't think it's that, but I do think you're on the right track. I think it is careerism, and I think there's a healthy dose of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there, you know, once you get inside the Beltway, there are clear, you know, spoken and unspoken guidelines about what you talk about and what you don't talk about. And again, we're just using the Swift Boat Veteran, but you know, in the middle of August, if you want to be on Hardball, you want to be on, you know, Meet the Press, you don't go on and you talk about a hoax and a dirty trick. Because you're not going to be invited back, because you're going to be labeled on the fringe, you know.
So you don't get to be a star.
You know, and if you want to sort of work your way up the ladder, I mean, Ann Coulter's in the news this week. Last year, Time magazine ran a Valentine cover story on her. The week before, they named her one of the most 100 influential people in the world. Jay Carney wrote this Valentine to her. You know, a couple months later, he became the Washington bureau chief. I mean, people understand how this game is played. You admire right-wing kooks, and you make fun of left-wing activists, and everyone just sort of goes along and gets along.
It's awful. Well, I appreciate you writing the book, and I hope it raises awareness of what the hell is happening out there, and if anything, inspires a couple of kids to be real journalists.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Eric Bullock, for being with us.
My pleasure.
That was Eric Bullock. The book is Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. Stay with us. Paul F. Tompkins will be here.
And now he's the force that drives Japanese whaling, Mark Maron.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. I think that hummingbird is under my shelf. I'm going to find it. Bill and I are going to go to record something in the garage, and it's going to fall out of the earphones.
No, that hummingbird is out flying around.
I like your optimism. See, this is what you have in place of a belief in God, is this strange belief that the hummingbird that can't fly out of my garage, whose wing was broken and jumped out of the bowl off the napkin bed I built it, and somehow it magically went through the wall.
Wing was broken?
Something was broken.
Oh, it's dead.
That's the Jim I know.
A rat guy.
That's the Jim I know.
Some rats, lucky rats, having a nice meal right now.
A giant spider, perhaps.
Yeah, spider rat.
Now we're talking. Hey, Paul Tompkins is a stand-up comedian. He was a writer and performer on HBO's Mr. Show with Bob and Dave. He has appeared on Real Time with Bill Maher, Late Night with Conan O'Brien. He was in a sitcom once upon a time.
Oh, yeah.
Called DAG with is David Allen Greer.
Wait. Hold for the applause.
Okay. Oh, thank you. He was on the Tenacious D series on HBO and his own one-person thing on that very same network. Mm-hmm. Someone said they saw you on Keith Olbermann the other night.
I was just on there. Was that last night? I think it was last night.
Was it last night? Did they call
no,
you?
No, it was 2 nights ago.
I'm going to finish the intro. He hosts his own monthly variety show cabaret thing here in L.A. at the very cool Largo nightclub, where he cads it up with the likes of Amy Mann, Jack Black, Fiona Apple. When's the next show? June 26th?
June 26th.
And you do a radio show thing? Because we had somebody else from that on here.
radio show? Oh, yes, I do. Padgett Brewster.
Padgett Brewster was here.
Once a month, my friend Ben Acker's show that's like a fake sort of live radio show that we do at the M-Bar.
Okay, let me finish the intro. So right now, in our very own studio, Paul F. Tompkins.
Thanks, everybody.
Hold for the applause. Yeah, that's great. That's tremendous. That is the first time he's ever done that.
Oh.
And we've been on the air 22 years.
That's
first
right.
time.
Time flies.
Very first.
Thank you very
much. So, Paul, what the hell, man? What the hell?
Yeah.
So you were talking on MSNBC about our friend Daryl Hannah, who we called in the tree the night before.
Yeah, yeah.
And
did you call her in the tree?
We talked to her from the tree.
How is she doing?
She was from in the cornfield when we talked to her, hosing herself down.
Right.
I'm not kidding. I'm talking to Daryl Hannah. She's doing a protest, and somehow or another we're talking about the South L.A. farm,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, a valuable cause and a
mm-hmm.
real thing.
Absolutely.
And she says, well, I'm out here in the cornfield. I have a tent set up. I just hosed myself down. And I had to really fight myself. Like, well, good that you're doing what you have to do out there to hold strong.
Yeah.
What'd you say about her, you mean bastard?
I said nothing but nice things. I said that because it was posited that why couldn't they just shoot her with a dart to get her down out of that tree?
Oh,
and
no.
I said, you don't want to do that with a Daryl Hannah because it's not sporting.
Right.
You want to give her a chance because
right.
if she gets shot with a dart, she falls out the wrong way. She might break her neck, and then you have to crush her skull with a rock.
Oh!
Yeah. It's humane. It's humane.
So I should have killed the hummingbird that I found that hit the window?
Well, that's a tough thing, man. A hummingbird with a broken wing, because those wings do a lot of work. A lot of work, exactly.
Yeah.
And if the one, I don't think he can get along with just the one.
Well, no, but the question is, I saw this thing hit the window. I
mm-hmm.
feed these things. I have an entire community. They call me dad. In my
right.
head, they do.
Sure.
And it hit the window, and it fell on the front stoop, and I
mm-hmm.
picked it up, and I did what you do when you're seven. You make it a bed, and you put it in a bowl or a shoebox, and you put it someplace where the cats won't eat it, and you watch it die.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Have you tried putting it in a jar with some grass?
That's the wrong
animal.
That
was always my method.
With the bird?
Well, anything. Anything that makes its way into the house. You put it in a jar with some grass. Take a screwdriver, punch some holes in the lid.
Top.
Yeah.
Watch it die.
Yeah.
That was a great, it was a very old Lewis Black joke he used to do about the hamsters. I can't remember what it was about goldfish and hamsters. They're just things you buy your kid to teach it what death is.
it's pretty much true.
So what have you been doing? What's been going on?
Well, you know, I just quit smoking.
Congratulations.
After almost 20, it was 19 years and one month, and I quit smoking.
Best thing you'll ever do in your life.
I can't, but it's like being in love.
Yeah.
I can't, every time I think about it, I get excited.
It's invigorating.
Yeah.
And it's what people don't realize when they do smoke, because I've blathered on about being a non-smoker
mm-hmm.
before, and people who listen sometimes are like, some of us aren't there yet, why don't you shut it? is literally within 2 days you feel results. You're like, holy crap!
Yeah,
I can breathe again.
I'm on my second full day. I think I'm on my
second just
full
2 days.
Day. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I rode my bike today, and it was like I realized at some point I would have been a lot more out of breath at this point normally
uh-huh.
than I have.
How much did you smoke?
I averaged a pack a day.
Yeah.
I averaged a pack a day.
But on drinking night?
Oh, boy. Yeah, I could get it up to two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you wake up after drinking and you have that stink? Well, I don't do
so
that
bad.
Anymore. You know,
so
coming
bad.
Out of your lungs and
yeah.
your skin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that weird ache in your
mm-hmm.
chest that somehow as a smoker you're able to dismiss somehow?
Oh, yeah.
With
yeah,
a
yeah,
cigarette?
Yeah. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
literally, I used to picture them bleeding some sort of black, bloody goo. And that's why I couldn't take a full breath. But you'd be like, I'm going to smoke and eat some eggs.
Mm-hmm.
That'll make this better.
Oh, well, see, I didn't smoke until after breakfast.
Come on, never?
Oh, no. That wasn't civilized.
Oh, dude, sitting down with like really strong coffee and about six cigarettes?
Well, see, that's the thing. I would eat first, then I would have my coffee, and I'd have the cigarettes with the coffee, and I was in heaven. And then...
Then you needed a nap.
And then I needed a nap. Absolutely. I was exhausted from so much pleasure. From so much pure enjoyment.
Well, I used to think it was because, like, if you drink, like, a triple espresso and then smoke, like, six cigarettes,
uh-huh.
literally your body's like, ah! And
yeah.
it has to, like, oh, it has
yeah,
to release.
Yeah.
Well, it took me about 15 years to quit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was just talking to you off the air. Like, I remember I smoked since I was 14 years old because
mm-hmm.
it was essential, and
yes,
I loved it.
Absolutely.
I loved smoking.
Absolutely.
But the first time I tried to quit, I was 19. Like, I knew then. So I
wow.
think... I think, honestly, in the back of my head, I've tried to quit on and off since I was about 25,
yeah.
and it took me till I was about 36 to actually get it done.
I think that's a lot of people's experience, though, because it is, you do realize fairly early on, like, this is not good, you know?
Yeah.
It's after you smoke because you want to look cool, and I started when I was 17 because I started doing stand-up. then I was in this world of the coolest people in the world.
Yeah.
You know? Stand-up comedians. Who's cooler?
Right. Until you're in it about 5 years. Yeah. You're like, oh, my God, you're just doing this so you can evade the tax collector.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You should be in jail.
Yeah. A lot of them are now, I think. I think a lot of the guys
were
established guys when I started out are probably either no longer with us or they're serving time.
What was the first time?
At our president's pleasure.
Yeah. What was the first time you realized that the road guy you were working with was not a good person and these were not the best people in the world?
It took me a while, and then it was shattering. It was shattering when I realized that. Well, first of all, when you realize somebody is a hack, that is like finding out there's no Santa Claus.
Yeah.
When you realize, I thought this guy was so funny, but there's 80 guys doing the same bit same way. And
that hurts a little.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
How could that be?
This is going to be different than I thought
it
would be.
Yeah, I mean, who thought of it originally? That's the weird thing, the difference between someone who's a thief and a hack.
Yeah.
A hack is just doing something you've heard.
Yeah.
A thief
is
actually worse because he's doing that guy's joke.
Yeah.
Hacks do things where you're like, you don't even know where that started.
Yeah. I've been doing this for about 20 years, and I'm almost ready to excuse the thief more than I am the hack. You know?
Really? Right.
Like, at least the thief has got some balls, you know?
Yeah.
I'm just going to take this material. Yeah.
He aspires to great things. Yeah. At least he'll take people who did great work.
Yes, he knows what good material is.
There you go. But I remember when things started to diminish, where you started really realizing that there were certain people in the business only because they had no choice. I knew a guy who's dead now. Who literally could not stay in one place because he was afraid he'd be arrested. He didn't like his name to be in the paper because he thought the tax people would find him.
Was it Ollie Joe Prater?
I was just going to say that.
Here's Prater Aid.
You could usually find him at the Comedy Store with gout and the cane. It was actually Frankie Bastille.
No, really?
Yeah.
Frankie was afraid of the law? He was a fugitive?
He had done jail time.
Wow.
You know, he had the Tibetan Book of the Dead tattooed around his arm. Yeah. What's some road wisdom? Was there any, moments with, old-timers where they were trying to lay down some stuff?
Oh, man. I mean, you know what? I just thought about that the other day, that I'm glad I've reached a point in my career where I don't have to listen to unsolicited advice anymore. And there was so much of that for a long time, and it was like some hacky dude trying to tell you you could learn something from this other hacky dude.
Yeah.
You know, like, dude, take a look at this guy, because you'll pick up a few things. Like, no, I don't want to be like you too.
Yeah.
That's the last thing I want. I don't know what it is yet, but I know this is not it.
It's so tricky about the road, because I know you're a guy, and I'm the same way, where I paid a lot of my dues as an opener in Boston doing one-nighters.
Mm-hmm.
I was a middle for a very short time, and then I went to San Francisco and I started headlining.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't do a lot of week-long road gigs. I'm not that guy, because I do this, I've done other things.
Absolutely.
And I think it's very touchy, because so few people survive the road with a personality that is actually original.
Yeah.
There's something about the road that just beats it out of them.
It's the survival instinct. It's you have to go to town after town, night after night, and you have to do well if you want to be asked back. You have to have a good show, and you have to sell the drinks and all that stuff, or your work will dry up. You know, the people that run these clubs have to know that you're going to deliver. So it's sort of like, a friend of mine put it that you are letting 100 people a night tell you how to do your job. Night after night, and there's no way around it. I mean, I admire anybody who comes up from that with any kind of, a guy like Hicks, that he did the road and still had a very singular personality. Like,
but
that's
the weird
amazing.
Thing is, but the interesting thing about Hicks is that he was actually the conscience of club owners. Was that it wasn't, they didn't care how he did. By having him at their clubs, they could justify that they're like, hey, we got Hicks here twice a year.
We care about comedy.
Yeah, he walks people and sometimes people get shot in the parking lot, but we have him here. Exactly. He was... But, all right, so now we're running out of time. So what can we plug? You want to plug something?
Paul F. Tompkins Show, if you live in the Los Angeles area, or if you feel like getting on a plane, come down to Largo, the June 26th, last Monday of every month.
And paulftompkins.com. Yeah?
Yeah. See if I updated it ever.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll be back with Johnny K Street.
And now he thinks Karl Rove is guilty of loving too much. Mark Maron.
Sam Cedar, tonight I'll be introducing him. What the hell difference does it make? Why am I even plugging this? What is wrong with me? By the time he... It's going to be over by the time this show...
No, it might still be going. Man. It's going to be going all night.
So you think the hummingbird was magic and it went through the wall?
Maybe, you know, how well... Where did you look around for it?
I'm going to look now. Maybe I have a magic bird. Here we go. Folks, there are a lot of big stories in the news this week, so let's get some bets down with our own Inside the Beltway odds maker, Johnny Cashery. Johnny, where's the action, man?
It follows me, baby. It's nice to be back in Los Angeles. You know, it's great to get away from the real world every few weeks and come to Hollywood, where people think Karl Rove was a second lead on Who's the Boss. And the big story is Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie's illegitimate kid, or as I like to call him, the Omen.
Yeah.
Mark, let me ask you a question.
Uh-huh.
Do I look clean to you?
Yeah, I suppose you do. I mean, what do you mean, Johnny?
Do I smell good?
I guess. I don't know. Is that cologne, or did you just fill the tank on your rental car?
So you would say I look fresh scrubbed.
Yeah, all right, sure. Why, scrubbed? Yeah, scrubbed.
Because I just took the bath of a lifetime on Karl Rove.
All right, how much?
I had Rove 100-1 for an indictment, and he walks free and clear. I thought it was a lock.
Uh-huh.
Let's put it this way. When O.J. heard the news, even he said, I don't believe it.
Right.
The bad news is Rove walked. The good news is Patrick Fitzgerald's family won't suddenly disappear from a cruise ship in the middle of the night.
So, I mean, what do you think happened, Johnny? Do you think Rove cooperated with the prosecution to get immunity or what?
You're reading my mind, baby. I'm giving him 50-1 on it.
Uh-huh.
My guess is there was more singing going on in that room than the last season of American Idol.
Yeah.
That Pillsbury dough bitch probably ratted out anyone and everyone, up to and including his wife and the guy who gets his coffee from at Starbucks.
Wait a minute, Johnny. Did you just call Karl Rove a Pillsbury dough bitch?
I might have.
I'll definitely take a piece of that action, my friend, for $5.
Take the gun out of my back. You're robbing me.
Hey, what'd you think of George Bush's trip to Iraq yesterday?
I'm glad I didn't have any action on that, because Bush visiting Iraq is a long shot no one would have taken.
Uh-huh.
He kept that trip quieter than the horizontal two-step he's doing with Condoleezza Rice.
Whoa.
That trip was the second time Bush decided to invade Iraq without telling anyone.
Yeah.
Of course, he was only there 5 hours, just long enough to visit the Halliburton money he's getting kicked back to him.
Exactly. Speaking of war crimes, what's your line on Gitmo?
Don't ask. The Bush administration struck another blow in the war against terror by waiting for three guys to kill themselves at Guantanamo. And that plan worked like a charm. I had a triple suicide going off at 200-1, and no one was interested.
Wow. Wow. I wish I had taken that bet.
Lots of prisoners left, Mark. That bet got less action than Ann Coulter in a New York firehouse.
So, wait. Now, speaking of her, what do you think about the comment she made, Johnny?
Like most people, I call Coulter the C-word. That psychotic hag has been whoring herself out for years.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not for the GOP, it's to sell those idiotic books she pulls out of her ass every other month.
Yep.
No one was buying her latest book. She was one step away from putting down a blanket and selling it on the sidewalk until she boosted her sales by slandering a bunch of widows.
Wow.
Ann Coulter's in the 14th minute of her 15 minutes of fame. 50-1, by this time next year, she'll look like Johnny Winter, and she won't be writing happy endings. She'll be giving them, baby, in a dirty little room on Sunset Boulevard in between crack binges.
Oh, that sounds perfect. I'll take that for 100.
You are covered.
Hey, Johnny, you mentioned Bush and Condi. I mean, you know, what kind of action do you have on the rumors of that really going down, that affair?
That one even surprised me. I thought the president was a eunuch.
Yeah, me too.
You know, a beady-eyed, brain-dead eunuch.
Yep.
Now it turns out he's playing hide the weapon of mass destruction with Condi. He taps our phones, he taps our computers, now he's tapping Condi.
Yeah.
Is there anything this guy won't tap?
Wait, so you think this affair is really happening?
No, of course not. Laura Bush and her staff just moved into the Mayflower Hotel because she likes room service. Supposedly, Bush gave the White House staff some new orders. If the Lincoln bedroom is rocking, don't come knocking. I'm giving even money that Bush is illegally invading Condi with no plans for an early withdrawal.
All right, all right. Okay, all right. Put me down for a grand.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you, man. So, Johnny, you always have some project going on. Is there anything you want to plug while you're out here?
Thank you. You read that perfectly. As a matter of fact, I do. I have something I'd like to mention to all my incredible fans out
mm-hmm.
here. Due to overwhelming demand, I'm in the process of putting together a Johnny K Street website. This will feature my lines on the biggest news stories of the day, interviews, gambling tips, and a feature I call K Street Confidential, a look inside the private life of Johnny K for the first time. Mm. But the big news is, Mark, for the first time ever, I'm going to start taking some Hollywood action, baby.
Uh-huh.
Bets on the box office, celebrities, TV, and the movies, you name it. This is the hottest thing in internet gaming right now. And who knows gaming better than Johnny K?
Yeah.
I'm currently talking to several sponsors about my website. Spots are going fast, but there's still time to get on board. So if there's any sponsors out there who want to link up and become part of the Johnny K experience online, email me at johnnykstreet@hotmail.com. And one more thing, Mark, before I go.
Yeah.
I'd just like to announce that I'll be premiering my new Tinseltown action, Johnny K's Hollywood Walk of Game, working title, for the first time right here on your show during my next appearance.
Great.
That's what's going down on K Street, baby.
All right.
I got Scarlett Johansson waiting in the car. You know, but, cute kid, but between you and me, a little clingy. I'm out of here.
All right. We'll see you later there, Johnny. Thanks for stopping by. Folks, very excited about our guest after the break, First Lieutenant Aaron Watata, who has publicly announced he will not go to Iraq if asked to go. He is not somebody protesting the military. He is protesting what he sees as an illegal war where 2,500, the Pentagon announced today, have died. 2,500 U.S. military deaths. We'll be back in a second.
Computer worms are attacking his privates. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. In a second, we'll be getting First Lieutenant Aaron Watata on the phone. Again, I want to say that the number of U.S. military deaths in the Iraq War has reached 2,500 today, according to the Pentagon. The Pentagon also said that 18,490 U.S. troops have been wounded in the war. It's not clear how many have lost legs, eyes, arms, hands, lives, minds. Tens of thousands. That's a low ball number. Perhaps up to 100,000 Iraqis have been killed in this war. Now, what's going on the House of the Congress, as I speak now, and obviously when this show airs, the debating will have been done, is that John Boehner, the majority House, the House Majority Leader, Boehner, however you want to say it, has put forth a non-binding resolution, primarily to create some political theater on the heels of what the GOP is seeing as some success in Iraq with the death of Zarqawi, with the new government forming, with President Bush going there and saying that perhaps they should work out some sort of amnesty for Sunni insurgents in the future in order to broker a peace after the conflict is over, which is kind of a crappy thing to say during a war because it would only inspire more killing, but this guy has no tact whatsoever. And from what I'm reading right now, obviously by the time this airs, we'll know more, is that the Democrats are standing strong and saying this is a grotesque misundertaking, this war, and it is not a justified war, no matter whether they killed Zarqawi or not. The interesting thing about the Boehner resolution is that what it tries to do more than anything else is equate the war on terror with the Iraq war. The president, the administration has tried to do this. This has been part of the game, just like they tried to connect Al-Qaeda in Iraq before the war, which didn't exist. The war on terror and the war on Iraq, certainly now, are distinctly different things, and from all indications, both are being lost. Okay, there is a report out from the foreign policy. This is from the Journal of Foreign Affairs. 100 leading American foreign policy analysts have put together a terrorism index. 86% of them said the world has grown more, not less, dangerous. Acts of terrorism around the world have gone up. If Zarqawi's claims, if any of what he tried to do has been done, there is an international network of free-floating cells in place, and this is primarily because of our presence in Iraq. So from that perspective, the war on terror is being compromised by the war in Iraq. And the war in Iraq, just because Zarqawi is dead. I'm not taking anything away from the election of a government or the assembling of a government. I hope it works. But the civil war is being exacerbated from all analysts' perspective by the presence of Americans. So both of those wars are being lost, whether you try to equate them or not. but they are two separate things. And I think Boehner is just trying to bait the Democrats, who from where I'm sitting now, this is the afternoon, I don't know how it looked when this is on, are standing strong. Pelosi said, look, it's not right. And there are plenty within the Republicans, Congress people, who are saying, look, we are not living up to our responsibility as a branch of government here. We are supposed to engage in oversight and regulate, or at least check this administration's ambitions. And hopefully some of that will start. But hopefully, more than anything else, the Democrats will come together on this and stay strong on being against this war, at least to Congress. Now, someone who is definitely against the war is our guest, Aaron Watada, who we're going to get on the phone here in just a second. For those of you who don't know, Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, he joined the Army in 2003 because he believed in the war in Iraq. Okay? Now it is 2006. He has turned in his resignation in protest of that same war, and is what up to now, I think, an unprecedented act in this war, and that is an officer's public dissent. And I also think it's important that you realize that Lieutenant Watada does not want to leave the military. This is not against the military. He is standing up for what he believes about this war. He could face a court-martial, dishonorable discharge, but he is standing up for the truth here. He is on the phone with us now. Welcome to the show, Lieutenant Aaron Watada.
Thank you, Mark.
You bet. Now, what made you decide on a public dissent as opposed to probably what would have been a much different situation had you just done it privately within the base?
Sure. Well, the main thing that I wanted to do was, I think when I was making my decision, to refuse the unlawful orders to take part in this war, was I was looking at the people in the past, and especially people just recently within the military who have resisted the call for this war, and it gave me a certain amount of inspiration and hope. And I wanted to do the same, for I felt there were a lot of people still within the military who had their doubts. So it was, I first contacted these support groups to just put the word out that this, I was making this stand and this is what I was going through, and you know, to give others some sort of inspiration.
Uh-huh. Now, I have just read today that the Pentagon reports about 8,000 soldiers are actually, have been reported AWOL. So that means, you know, certainly in sentiment, you are not alone. I have talked to other members of the armed forces who anonymously share your feelings, but I don't think any has done it at your rank, nor with the amount of knowledge that you're bringing to this. What is the situation now?
Well, basically, after I made that public announcement last week, I've been accused of making disloyal statements officially, and they're opening up an Article 15-6 investigation on to whether formally charge me or not. Still waiting for the day when they're going to tell me to get on the plane, which should be within a few weeks. And at that point, I have told them that I simply will just not board the plane.
What are they trying to prosecute you on?
Oh, for the when I spoke out, they're trying to
a protected speech.
Right, they're trying to prosecute me for, or trying to find out if they should prosecute me for making disloyal statements, I guess, against the government or the president.
Can they?
It's very iffy, very arbitrary. You know, disloyal statements is such a subjective term.
Mm-hmm.
Anything could be considered disloyal, I guess, or disrespectful.
Huh.
But certainly, I think none of the statements I made were trying to usurp the government or anything like that. So I don't think I broke the law in any way. And it is the right of every, even people within the military, to speak out their mind and their beliefs, as long as it's, you know, not in uniform and not during duty hours.
So they're probably just bullying you, I would imagine.
I think so. I mean, they've said in so many words that, you know, you don't want to add more charges to you. And certainly they want to set the example and to make other people who would think of doing the same thing think twice.
Yeah. Let's talk about that before we get into the history of your act. What's been the reaction of your comrades there, of people on the base, just on a social level?
Certainly there's been, you know, a few who have been hostile.
Mm-hmm. How does that play itself out?
I'm sorry?
How does that play itself out?
Well, nobody has come directly to my face and said this is what I think, mm-hmm. but I have received emails from those within the military, saying what they think. But, you know, I've also received letters of support from those within the military and also those on base. There's been a few instances, guys coming up and shaking my hand, saying that you're doing the right thing. Thank you. And then, you know, there are, I think for the most part, people are either indifferent or they may not have the same beliefs, but they support my right to speak out and say my mind.
Mm-hmm. Now, what made you decide, what is it, one thing or a series of things that that this war was and is illegal?
I think it was a series of things. And not only is the war itself illegal, but those who have started the whole thing, have, in my mind, have not been held accountable for it. And the danger there is that if nobody speaks up against that, holds them accountable, that they believe that they can keep on doing the same thing, committing the same crimes, violating the same American laws.
I think it's an amazingly courageous thing you're doing, and I just hope that that the rest of the country sees and hears it. You know, certainly we're going to put it on my show. I guess what I want to know is I spoke to Marjorie Cohn today about that what you're doing is actually a responsibility of an officer, according to the Nuremberg principles, that apparently if you see it as an illegal war and it is justifiably illegal, it is your responsibility to speak out along those lines.
Right, Mark. That's exactly the way I see it. There was a time where I knew the truth, but yet I still thought I could do nothing as an officer, and that really tore me up on the inside because I just saw this pain and suffering by the soldiers and their families and the Iraqis, and I just felt so helpless that there was nothing I could do. And then I kind of realized that, well, one, not only was I totally helpless, I was still a person and I had a responsibility as a human being to act, but I could also do so within, you know, under military regulations and under the law. You're right, it is my responsibility as an officer to, you know, to speak out against misconduct and only follow lawful orders.
And the reason it's illegal are what? Can you list them for me?
Sure. The war itself is not a war based out of necessity, so it's a war of aggression, which is strictly prohibited by the UN Charter, which we have signed on to, America has signed on to, and the Nuremberg Principles, which we also have signed on to. Article 6 of the Constitution says that any treaty that any international treaty that America signs on to, those treaties and laws become domestic federal law.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we continue to break those laws by the government's policy and the condoning of human rights abuses in Iraq and the indiscriminate killing of civilians. Those are all violations of the Geneva Convention, 1907 Hague Convention, and the Army's own law of land warfare, Field Manual 27-10.
So now, unfortunately, if I understand correctly, the only way this is most likely going to get into a courtroom for you to make your case is in a court-martial.
Correct. But in order for me to have a fair trial, I believe there also needs to be a lot of public support. The public has to demand that there must be a fair trial and that we must, in that trial, debate whether this is actually a lawful war and that the order to participate in it is actually lawful or not.
So the way this is going to play out, most likely, is that you're going to be called to get on a plane to go to Iraq. You're going to say, I will not go because of my principles and because of my stated protest. They will put you under arrest. There will be a court-martial proceedings, and the case will be made against this war as being an illegal war, and for your right to stand in protest of that and to be treated as a responsible officer as opposed to somebody who has dissented.
Right. Mark, that's my hope. I hope that that the judge overseeing this trial will be able to give me a fair shake and will not be just, you know, another enabler of the administration and try to protect them by not allowing us to debate the merits of the legality of this war. There was an officer named Lieutenant Malcolm Smith over in the UK. He also said that the war was illegal and he would not go for his third tour over to Iraq. And he was ready to debate the merits of the legality of the war, and the judge would not allow the war to be put on trial, and he was subsequently court-martialed and sentenced to 8 months in prison.
There was also another guy in England who was a member of their AOS, or I can't remember.
SAS.
He was a high-level, highly qualified soldier who had a similar protest His protest was that he did not enlist in the British Army to do the United States to enforce United States foreign policy. And from what I read, he was given he was discharged, honorably discharged, with recommendations from his commanding officer. I don't know what the difference was in the case here, but Lieutenant Aaron Watada, what can people like myself, people who are on the radio, how can I help you?
The best way you can help me is just getting the word out to everybody that, you know, that we need to look at the issue of this war. Is it legal or is it not? And if it is illegal, then we cannot force members of the military to participate in a crime.
Mm.
And then, you know, the people within the military who have these doubts that the war is illegal need to know that the public supports them. So the public needs to be very vocal. It needs to be, you know, a consolidated, strong effort by everybody within this country. I think it is a responsibility of all Americans. And I think a lot of Americans have forgotten that there's a war being fought over there.
Yeah, they certainly don't know what it's about or what's really going on, that's for sure. So you've got a hard few weeks ahead of you, Lieutenant, but I think you're doing an amazing thing, and I'll support you any way I can. I don't know if you're going to be open to doing interviews. I know it's the timing. It's hard for you to do one because you can only do it off the base. But if you want, I can put some of the other Air America hosts in touch with your contact, and perhaps you can get the word out on a couple of the other shows. Would you want me to do that?
Sure, that would be great. And also, if you could have your listeners visit the thankyoult.org website, there's going to be postings on what's happening day to day. And I think on the 27th of this month, there's going to be a national effort to protest by being charged and court-martialed.
Well, thanks for the service you're doing for the country, Lieutenant, and thanks for doing this interview. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Mm-hmm. We'll be back in just a second with the rest of the show, folks, so stay with us.
He swears the only kick Zarqawi wants. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. What a show. That was a good time. A heavy time. Go to thankyoult.com. .org and see what's up with Lieutenant Watada, and that could unfold into something interesting. I hope more people pick up on that story. Let's get into this, and I'll tell you what's going on tomorrow. This is the short order news for tonight, version. The end of the show. Here's your information. With the help of Antonin Scalia, the Supreme Court ruled today that police armed with a warrant can barge into homes and seize evidence even if they don't knock. Law enforcement officials are elated, saying they needed the extra 3 to 5 seconds to tear up the Fourth Amendment. This ruling will enable police to stop people from flushing evidence down the toilet and reduce the need for police to plant evidence in someone's home. According to Scalia, if it's good enough for the Kool-Aid pitcher, it's good enough for me. Yeah. No meta. The GAO found that at least $1 billion in disaster relief payments by FEMA were improper and potentially fraudulent. Said one Bush official, quote, "If we knew the money was going to be spent on jewelry, strippers, and vacations, we would have sent it to our corporate donors," end quote. The office found recipients fraudulently received millions of taxpayer dollars that would have been put to better use being lost by Halliburton. A retired farmer who says he served in the German army in World War II is turning part of his land into a memorial to a leader he claims is misunderstood, Adolf Hitler. "And on this farm he had some Nazis, E-I-E-I, with a Sieg Heil here and Sieg Heil." Ironically, a black guy, a Mexican, and a rabbi had their car break down at the farm and had to sleep with the farmer's daughter. To celebrate his beliefs, the farmer plans to hold a rock festival on his farm and call it Woodstock. Huh?
Woodstock. I bet there are, you know, a lot of goose stepping on that farm.
Sure. I've got to stop the music. Stop it.
A lot of geese there.
Lose it. Lose the music. So what should I name the magic hummingbird if he's going to become mythic until I find him dead somewhere?
I name him Hummer.
Oh, you can't do that to the bird. Which are
you? I wasn't suggesting you give the bird a Hummer. I just said name it Hummer.
Hummer after the car or after a Hummer?
It's up to you, fella. You're the comic. You're the stand-up.
You are the comic, my friend.
You're the comic.
You're the guy who sits over there and writes funny things? Makes some funny comments? I'm sorry you're so sick, buddy. Tomorrow we got Vic Gabarini, music critic, here with Vic's Picks. We've got a few records he's going to go over. They better be fresh, Bill Kohler, you and your old hippie friends. I don't want him to go back too far in the Wayback Machine. You know, and pull out, guess what? What have we got here?
Get some easy beats.
It's a new Jerry Garcia record done by some weird deadheads with a Ouija board. It sounds great, though. Steve Hill, the author of 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy and Owner's Manual for a Concerned Citizen, will be here. Andy Ostroy from the Ostroy Report, ostroyreport.blogspot.com, who we've talked to a couple times, who is a friend of mine, whose wife I know. Yeah, we're going to go out to dinner with them tomorrow night. So I told him he could be on the show just so the dinner thing would be easier. Nah, I'm kidding. He's a smart guy. I'm going to go do Sam Cedar's show that you're going to hear before this. Weird, huh? That's trippy, right, Bill? Oh, dude. It's trippy, man. All right. Good night, sheeple. Trails, man.